Greetings, and welcome to Research on Religion, a weekly podcast series devoted to the social scientific study of religion. I'm Anthony Gill, your host, professor of political science at the University of Washington, and distinguished senior fellow at Baylor University's Institute for Studies of Religion, the gracious sponsor of our podcast. We encourage you to visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org to post comments, ask questions, access additional material related to today's program, and to find out what is happening at the Institute. All right, let's begin. My guest today, clocking in for his seventh appearance on the podcast, is Professor Rodney Stark, a distinguished professor of the social sciences at Baylor University and co-founder and co-director of Baylor's Institute for Studies of Religion, our patron organization. A prolific scholar and author, Professor Stark has written 40 books and over 150 academic articles. Among those books are some of my all-time favorites, including For the Glory of God, How Monotheism Led to Reformations, Science, Witch Hunts, and the End of Slavery, which is a staple of my religion and politics course for the past 10 years, Bearing False Witness, Debunking Centuries of Anti-Catholic History, The Triumph of Faith, Why the World is More Religious Than Ever, Why God, Explaining Religious Phenomena, and most recently, Reformation Myths, 5 Centuries of Misconceptions and Some Misfortunes. That will be the primary focus of our discussion today. We will provide links to these books along with his personal website and Baylor ISR website over at our website, so please peruse those resources. Baylor has some big events planned for the Reformation, so if you happen to be in Central Texas around the Waco area near the end of October, check out their website and see if you can attend some of those really, really good talks and seminars. Rod, welcome once again to Research on Religion.
I'm delighted to be with you again, Johnny.
It is great because you continue to crank out books and all these things are absolutely fantastic. And you wrote a very timely one because we're now about a month or so away from the 500th anniversary of what many folks would say is the birth of the Protestant Reformation. And that's the celebration of Luther's nailing of his 95 theses on the door of the Castle Church in Wittenberg on October 31st, 1517. However, your new book, titled Reformation Myths, starts out rather provocatively by saying, what Reformation? And you also mentioned it's not necessarily the Reformation, but 3 Reformations. Explain that if you could.
Well, you know, pretty clearly, Luther's was in some ways the first successful Reformation. There had been prior attempts and people ended up getting burned and whatnot. But in addition to Luther, there was Calvin's Reformation, and there was what ended up being a Reformation produced by Henry VIII. None of them liked one another's Reformation. The Reformations, they persecuted one another. I mean, Henry VIII used to hang Lutherans and Calvinists. So there's a lot of variation in here, and you know, what are we actually celebrating? And there's a tendency for these events to ignore that problem, to talk about the Reformation, and there really wasn't one.
Yeah, it's interesting how you talked about this, that each of those different Reformations, of the three, and one could actually probably talk about multiple Reformations beyond that, Luther was kind of salvation by faith alone. What were Calvin's Reformation and the English Reformation? How did they relate to
that? Well, Calvin, of course, said you have no control over salvation. It's a gift from God. It's set before you're born. There's nothing you can do about it. And Henry VIII, since he wasn't really starting anything new, but was just trying to get a divorce and get free of the Pope, the English Reformation and the faith it inspired believed in both faith and works.
Mm-hmm. Now, it might be claimed that we are celebrating the rise of Protestantism. If we can't say the Reformation, and it's many Reformations, we could at least say we're celebrating the rise of Protestantism. But you also note that this is problematic as there are a lot of Protestantisms. And in fact, you claim that the term Protestant is largely meaningless unless you use it very narrowly. So what do you mean by that?
Well, first of all, there are about maybe as many as 30,000 Protestant denominations on earth. There are 1,000 in the United States, 500 in Great Britain. They differ a lot. Some of them are very liberal. Some of them are very conservative. So it's hard to know what one means. As a matter of fact, for years we've had data available showing that, say, the array of the major Protestant denominations in the United States, you take any of the central Christian doctrines, and you'll find enormous variation among them in the percentage of people who believe them, and that there's much more contrast within Protestantism than there is between some average Protestants and the Roman Catholics.
Yeah, a lot of that work has come from Gordon Melton, who we've had on the show
before.
Yeah,
well, you know, the average Protestant really doesn't exist.
Yeah. So you give us a narrow definition of this. You say that Protestantism is a religious grouping that doesn't accept the authority of the Pope. Is that a fairly good working definition?
That's probably about as specific as you can get. That they're not Eastern Orthodox Catholics, and they aren't, of course, they don't accept the Pope either, and that they aren't Roman Catholics, and that they're still Christians. And then I guess you're talking about Protestants. Although, when I got to Baylor, I started running into people around here who said, Baptists aren't Protestants. They have some crazy notion that they go way, way back before Luther, and consequently were always there, if you will. And it's poor history, but it's interesting.
Yeah, it is interesting. Is that widely shared around the Waco area? They just say, "Well, we."
I don't really know. I know that we had a couple of people in our office staff who didn't believe the Baptists were Protestants.
Wow, absolutely fascinating. The other thing that you note in your book too is that Protestantism is a term that wasn't created by Protestantism. Who actually created
that's
it?
That's true too.
Yeah.
I mean, it was actually first used by the Roman Catholic Church to identify all these dissidents.
Mm-hmm. Which is kind of interesting. Okay, so if we qualify the term Protestantism to mean somebody who doesn't accept the authority of the Pope, and we hold aside the Orthodox and stuff, and if we consider Reformation to be, you know, pretty broad and often misused words, let's just operate from the understanding of the casual observer and dive into some of the myths that are held about Luther's Reformation and the surrounding ones, namely, most notably, Calvin's. The first one of these misconceptions was that Luther's rebellion was a popular uprising of the masses longing for some kind of religious renewal. Why? What do you have to say about that?
Nonsense. It was a uprising of clergy and of some upper class Germans that left the masses completely untouched. I mean, it's widely believed that somehow, because the Lutheran churches suddenly were preaching in German instead of Latin, so that the masses could understand them, that they all started coming to church. But they didn't. And we know this because the Lutherans, surprisingly, sent out inspectors to all their churches year after year after year for about a century. And we've got their reports. The good Germans didn't throw anything away. And a wonderful historian named Strauss got them all, organized them, and found the churches were empty. There were preachers who told the inspectors, "I often don't hold church because nobody comes." There's another problem, of course, is it isn't clear from these reports that it would have been a good thing if more people had come, because the people who did come, and remember, in many areas, they were required by law to come to church, and even though they didn't come. But those who did constantly were coming in. They were drunk. They were sleeping, they were playing cards, they were giving the minister a hard time, nobody sang, they brought their dogs, there's a lot of barking going on. So this is kind of what the churches were like in Germany. But over in England, the story is the churches were empty, and there are English bishops who say, not only if people can tell you nothing from the scriptures, they don't even know there are any scriptures.
Mm-hmm.
Europe was a pretty irreligious place in terms of the, you know, the rank and file public all along. So that when people talk about the churches being empty today, and this is supposed to be some big proof of secularization, they were always empty.
Yeah. One of my favorite lines in the book, and you have a number of them. The way you write is just absolutely fantastic. You talk about Strauss going around and gathering all these notes of these inspectors that are going around, and the thing that they found was not evidence of piousness, but evidence of drinking, horrible blasphemy, whoring, witchcraft, and soothsaying, and widespread contempt for the clergy, which is quite surprising. We think of, you know, we see all the pictures on the walls, the murals of the pious medieval period of time. I guess nobody was painting the fact that they were bringing their horses and playing poker at the time.
Yeah, yeah.
Where does this notion that the Protestant Reformation was this rebellious uprising of the masses, where does that come from?
I suppose, ultimately, perhaps surprisingly, it comes from the Marxists, because the assumption that all such events are uprisings of the masses, and in fact, very few events are uprisings of the masses. Most new religious organizations are founded by the middle class. I mean, you know, take something like Methodism. Yeah, you get all kinds of people talking about how the poor are suddenly were touched by religion, by Wesley, and Methodism happened all over England and all over the United States. And somehow it doesn't seem to register that Methodism was founded at Oxford by university undergraduates, not by a bunch of minors, and that it so remained.
Yeah, people at Oxford had plenty of time to do this, whereas all the people, the peasants in the fields and in the mines, were too busy working, essentially.
Yeah, that's right. By the way, let's go back even to all these people in Germany who are not coming to church. They're not without religion. They're unchurched. And their religion, as a consequence, is at various times, is a whole mixture of superstition, of some Christianity and a lot of paganism and all kinds of stuff wrapped together in an awful lot of magic, and they use it to get by in life. But it's not the kind of thing, you know, Luther would have recognized it as nothing but, you know, he would have had all these people burned.
Yeah. Well, one of the things that a number of historians have cited as evidence that it was an uprising of the masses was the German Peasants' Revolt, or sometimes called the Peasants' War of 1524 to 1525. I mean, that seems to be, you know, these peasants in the farms rising up and saying, "You go, Luther." Why is that not evidence of religious uprising?
Well, there might have been quite a bit of religion involved in the Peasants' Revolt. But it sure wasn't Lutheranism, and there was an awful lot of religion painted on it from the outside. There were all kinds of revolts that went on in Europe over the last 2,000 years. It's a wonder that the peasants weren't always in revolt, actually, under the conditions in which you know, their tenure, their land, and whatnot was operating, but it was no important thing. And of course, Luther condemned them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And to the extent that there was, again, it was the religion of the peasants' revolt was the kind of religion I was talking about a little bit earlier, that of the people, which was an unchurched kind of magical muddle of stuff.
The Peasants' Revolt, too, wasn't just merely a religious revolt or didn't have religion as its primary motivator. I mean, a lot was opportunistic rebellion against some of the nobility. Is that correct?
Right. I mean, you know, they wanted a better deal, particularly as to land tenure.
Now, when it comes to some of the elites here, there's also talk about the Protestant Reformation as leading to a number of conversion amongst the elites, the pious princes, as they so say, and some of the pious kings. Were these folks the ones who were, you know, listened to Luther and said, "Well, my gosh, Luther, you got some good ideas there. We're joining you in your religious movement."
No, I tell you what they said is, now we don't have to worry about being excommunicated anymore. We can tell the Pope that we aren't going to send any more tax money to Rome. We can tell the Pope that we're going to confiscate all his lands, and he can't do anything about it, because if we're Lutherans, then excommunication is a meaningless thing. And indeed, you can look and see which areas turned Lutheran and which remained Catholic almost perfectly on the basis of which rulers had a lot to gain by confiscating from the church, and which ones already were in control of the church property didn't have much to gain. And the ones who didn't have much to gain, like France and Spain and whatnot, stayed Catholic. And the German princes and the Scandinavians, who had a lot to gain because the church held huge amounts of land, as much as, maybe as much as half in some places of the land and the property was owned by the church. And if you went Lutheran, you confiscated all of that stuff. What Henry VIII got was not just the right to marriage, but huge, huge amounts of money, gold. It was a huge payoff. And this would have happened earlier, but one thing about Protestantism, whether it was the English version or the Swiss version or the German version, is it gave the elites cover against the church so that they could confiscate church property safely. When everybody was Catholic, to get excommunicated was a very dangerous situation, and they didn't risk it. But now it didn't matter.
One of the more interesting things in your book that I had not known was that Poland was once fully Protestant, but then they eventually returned back to Catholicism. And that, I think, illustrates some of the points that you're making here, specifically with relation to the elites and such. So why was Poland once Protestant, and then why'd they go back?
They started changing when they were doing what was going on in Germany as well. They were confiscating church property and whatnot, and the church rushed in and made a deal and said, "You're welcome to the property, but just stick with us." And so they did.
Yeah. Now, your book is not only called Reformation Myths, but you also include misfortune in the subtitle of the book. And the second and third chapters of the book deal with two misfortunes, which are, first, state churches enforce piety, and then second, nationalistic states as the other misfortune. These two are somewhat interconnected. So let's start with the first one. What is the misfortune of state churches enforced piety?
Well, if you look back at what was called one time Christendom, there was a kind of, you might call it, pluralism that prevailed in the ruling sphere, if you will. The kings and the dukes and the princes were not entirely free to impose their will on the people, because the church was always there as a challenge, and the church claimed greater authority, and frequently the confessors not only convinced kings and princes and whatnot to do better things, less criminal things, less nicer things, if you will, but sometimes really stepped in and threatened excommunication unless they shaped up and stopped doing certain kinds of things. And as a matter of fact, as one with comes out at great length in my book on the Crusades, they often made their heads of state even go on pilgrimages. They made them do all kinds of things to clean up their act, if you will. And that was an important thing. And when the prince got rid of the bishop and became his own bishop, and the church was his church, that kind of dualism or pluralism vanished. There was nobody any longer to say, hey, that's bad. Look, you can't kill wives. You can't do this. You can't do that. You can't oppress the people this way. There was a real damper on heads of state, on the secular powers, if you will, as long as there was a universal church. But once it becomes a state church and the head of state is the head of the church, this whole breaking system goes away, and these churches, and along with it their leaders, could be far more repressive, and they were. And one of the ways that is very obvious is they started passing laws about religious life. All over Scandinavia, it became, and I'll get to England in a minute, but it became the law that you had to go to church X number of times a year. You could only miss certain number of times or you were in trouble. That you had in most of Scandinavia, for example, there was a law that said no more than three people could pray together in a group without the presence of an ordained Lutheran clergyman. And that was, of course, to prevent people from forming little sects that might be competing with the state church. It was a very repressive system. It didn't work very well, and it often wasn't very well enforced. And that's what come to England. Under Elizabeth, there was a law requiring church attendance, and there was a fine imposed for every missed Sunday, and that fine consisted of what would amount to about 2 weeks' pay for a skilled craftsman, which is a pretty severe fine. It wasn't enforced, and it was soon repealed, and the reason is nobody paid any attention to it. It was just widely and totally ignored. And once in a while, they'd bring charges against somebody, and he'd defend himself by saying, look, on the average Sunday during the time you're talking about, there were only 20 people on average in church, but there were 250 people who were supposed to be in church. So why are you picking on me? And it just blew away. And so after about 50 years, the law was retracted. These state churches were much more repressive than the Catholic Church had been, and it's because there was no limit to their power. Instead of having two bases of authority that kind of balance one another off some, you had only one. And it was kind of a nasty time.
The other thing that you mentioned that's related to this is that states became increasingly nationalistic as opposed to adhering to a Christendom, a broader concept of what Europe meant. What was the misfortune of nationalistic states?
Well, let me tell you quickly how it happened. It's what you had in what was called Christendom. Is that, well, all the heads of state and all the royalty and whatnot, mostly they didn't go to universities, but the heads of the churches and their confessors and their instructors, because they were, in fact, educated, did go to the universities. The universities were all Catholic. There was this common language of Latin, which, of course, no one spoke except the educated and the clergy. And there was kind of a unity in the arts, and not only in philosophy and science, but in the arts. I mean, the church supported music, it supported art, and everybody had kind of a similar taste. Nobody was writing in German or in English or in French. They were all writing in Latin. And then, of course, it all fell apart. And pretty soon, you know, one of the great things that is credited to Luther is that he published the German Bible. And that in doing so, he basically created a literary German. And people started writing in German and writing in English. And we get Shakespeare and we get Goethe and et cetera, et cetera. And what comes from this are national cultures. And pretty soon you've got, you know, the French saying, we're the most educated and sophisticated people on earth, and our culture is the greatest. And the English are saying, nonsense, you don't even have decent meat. And, you know, the Germans are hypercritical. And what's happening, of course, is the rise of nationalism. And while I am, by the way, have nothing against nationalism as such, it had some pretty nasty consequences when it came to wars. You know, medieval warfare was constant, but it was very mild. First of all, the numbers involved were extremely small. When the English were invaded, 1099, you're talking about a force of 10,000 under William the Conqueror coming in and beating a force of about 7,000. We're not talking about hundreds of thousands involved. And for a long time, the armies were very small, on top of which they were highly professional and they didn't fight very bloody wars. As a matter of fact, they had very few battles. They'd have long wars, but very few battles, because it was not really an age of battle as it was an age of castles. You know, you'd lay siege to some guy's castle, and after a year or two, you gave up, or he gave up, but nothing much happened. Well, when you got the really nationalist state going, and you got the French Revolution, the first thing that finally happens came the draft. And suddenly, Napoleon had an army of half a million. 100 years before that, the great Prussian armies were armies of 25,000. And now suddenly we're talking about half a million here and half a million there. And you end up losing 30,000 French troops in one battle, a battle that you won. That was Borodino outside Moscow. But the wars became extraordinarily big and very, very bloody. And nationalism inspired it in many ways. I mean, we forget about World War I when everybody danced and sang as the armies marched off to war. And the marvelous nationalism that went on. They changed the names of dogs. The German Shepherd became a... I've forgotten the name they used. Sauerkraut became Victory Cabbage. And they changed the names of cities. Berlin, you know, places were called Berlin in Canada, and they became Kitchener, and all sorts of things like that went on. Nationalism was a potent force if it got out of hand, and it did, you know, in the 20th century. World War One and World War Two, which was really just one big world war. And again, I'm not against nationalism. I think Brexit probably made good sense, but it can have some very bad effects.
Mm-hmm. In terms of thinking about the wars and the nationalist wars, one of the critiques of the Protestant Reformation, often made by those folks who mourned the loss of Christendom, was that many of these wars that sprung up in the first century or so after Luther's act were religious-based wars. To what extent are those wars, the religious wars, really religious versus something else going on?
Oh, I think they were basically wars of religion. You know, the Catholic states wanted to reimpose the church, if you will, and the Protestant states were not about to do that, and they were nasty, bloody, long wars, and they gave rise to an awful lot of unfortunate things, including I wrote a whole book about the false history, anti-Catholic history that the British and the Dutch invented during those wars, that then lived on, unfortunately. I mean, things like, an obvious one is that Columbus had to discover that the world was round because the church turned down, got the people to turn down his voyage on the grounds of the world was flat. That wasn't true. At the time, every educated person, including all church people, knew the earth was round. And there's no scent of this in anything from the time. And it first appears in the middle of the 19th century. And the guy who wrote it also wrote about the Headless Horseman, a novelist. And it appeared out of nowhere, but it was immediately accepted. And when I was a kid, I was taught in the school that Columbus had to prove the world was round. And as a matter of fact, it's still in textbooks in large numbers of large places in Protestant Europe.
Yep, no, that's one thing that I still remember from grade school as well. One of the other things that's talked about in terms of the Protestant Reformation, and again, we acknowledge that there's a multiplicity of reformations, but perhaps the most talked about one, it comes up with the famous sociologist Max Weber. You know, he wrote a book called The Protestant, or perhaps it should be called The Puritan or Calvinist Ethic. And you mentioned that this Protestant ethic is largely a myth. Explain that, please.
Well, you know, within about 4 or 5 years after he published the book, which was in 1903-1904, he was being rejected by competent historians, as he has been again and again and again and again, on the very simple grounds that capitalism existed full-blown and fully developed centuries before the Reformation. So how could the Protestant ethic have arisen, given rise to capitalism, when capitalism existed long before there was any Protestantism? It's a very silly kind of thing to linger on, and yet you're right, it's still in all the textbooks. Not so long ago, it was picked as one of the four most influential social science books of the 20th century. And I think that's true, it was that influential, but it's wrong, and it's silly. And Weber sought no evidence whatever, and it's again and again and again been demonstrated that capitalism originated in Southern Europe, purely Catholic places, was taken north by Catholics, that the whole thing was well in place long before Luther was born. And consequently, you know, consequences cannot happen before their causes.
Mm-hmm. Now, there's a lot of different reasons why capitalism actually began a couple centuries earlier in Catholic areas, or why the Catholic Church actually fomented the rise of capitalism. What are some of those reasons? This goes back a little bit to your book on the victory of reason.
Well, I mean, the religious orders had big estates, and they got bigger and bigger and more complicated, and they were making a lot of money. And unlike the nobility, which is you could count on having an idiot son, and every third generation, you know, the family would fall, everything would go to pieces. The religious orders in their properties, that didn't happen because they didn't have any idiot sons coming to power. They were meritocracies, and the people who replaced, the people running things were each generation the smart ones. And they began involving business practices and economic practices of specialization and trading, and they invented banking and then they solved the problem of, what do you do if I'm in Italy and I want to buy something in Holland? Do I load a wagon full of gold and drive to Holland to pay for it and get robbed along the way? So they came up with letters of credit in exchange so that they were starting to float paper economies way, way back. It's a wonderful story, and I've done a book trying to outline it because it's so much fun to see it happen. But all good historians know that this is complete nonsense. Unfortunately, social scientists are lousy historians and pretty ignorant people in general.
One of the areas where the science, the social science, oftentimes gets it wrong as well is the rise of the scientific revolution itself in the mid to late 16th century, usually attributed to the rise of Protestantism, more specifically Puritanism. And it's seen that Protestantism freed the European mind from religious superstition. Comment on that, if you could.
It was, first of all, there was no scientific... There's a lovely book that just came out, and the guy begins this great line. There was no scientific revolution in the 17th century, and this is a book about it. If you can't get rid of the belief, so if you're going to write about it, you might as well use the term. But what it was is normal scientific progress. And it was a great flowering. It was a wonderful time. Guys like Newton and whatnot were marvelous. But you can see them coming. And Newton himself said, hey, if we see farther than others is because we stand on the shoulders of giants. And he meant it. And what he was saying is that, look, I learned a lot from my teachers, and I'm taking the next steps. And these steps have been building up for centuries. On top of that, to claim it was a Protestant thing ignores the fact that more than half of the great figures of the time of the so-called revolution were Catholics, many of them clergy. So how in the world can it be a Protestant thing when you've got all these Catholic clergymen being major figures in the discoveries that are going on? Well, of course you can't. And so there it is. Again, we wouldn't be hanging on to these notions, the Protestant ethic and the Protestant rise of science, except for the fact that we're still deeply embedded in English-speaking countries with anti-Catholicism. I mean, since all the good scholars know this is nonsense, why does it endure, even though it's in scholarly groups it endures? And the activists, they continue to believe all sorts of things about that nasty Protestant church, including the notion that, for example, that Pope Pius XII was a big supporter of Hitler. This keeps coming up again and again out of the intellectual sections of, the new books keep appearing, and they get nice reviews in the New York Times and places like that, even though there's a whole string of prominent Jewish leaders who said nonsense. Pius was extraordinarily active in saving Jews during the Holocaust. Golda Meir says this man was wonderful, but we get some idiot French playwright or German playwright saying that he was a Nazi, and we all run and want to embrace it. That's craziness. I We're making progress on that front, but it's pretty slow. When I was a kid, there were a couple of women who made good livings traveling from one Protestant church to another across the United States and giving lectures about the sexual... They claimed to be ex-nuns, and they were giving lectures on the sexual antics that took place in the convents with Father Confessor. Well, that's gone. You know, we're not stuck with that kind of stuff anymore, but we've still got a long way to go.
Do you happen to remember the title of the book that talked about the No Scientific Revolution?
I could easily find it. I think I quoted in the chapter on the scientific revolution in my Reformation book.
We can go ahead and look it up for our listeners and link to it, because it sounds like an interesting book. I don't have a copy of it in front of me either, since I got the electronic version of this in advance and still waiting on my paper version.
Yeah, a guy named Stephen Shapin, S-H-A-P-I-N, and he wrote, there was no such thing as the scientific revolution, and this is a book about it. It's a lovely book. I can tell you when it came out here.
We'll go ahead and link to it for our listeners. One of the questions, in addition to the...
It came out in 1996, University of Chicago Press.
Okay. One of the other things that's linked to the scientific revolution, but perhaps on a broader philosophical level, is the Enlightenment. And many people note that the Enlightenment started in Scotland and spread to England in the 18th century, and many people link that to Protestantism as well. So to what extent is that a valid thing, or is that a myth, or what would you say there?
Two so-called Enlightenments. There's the one that, of course, begins with Voltaire and those folks. And all they were doing is pretending that theirs was a new age. And it wasn't. They wanted to say that suddenly they'd overthrown these dark centuries. They invented the notion of the dark ages, and we all learned about the dark ages in school. But if you even look in the usual encyclopedias today, they'll say the dark ages was a mythical age. Didn't happen. And, you know, it was probably the case that the people didn't write as good Latin as the Romans had, and so a few things like that. But during this period, at the fall of Rome, there were lots and lots of societies that were as advanced in all respects as Rome. At the start of the so-called Enlightenment, at the end of the so-called Dark Ages, Europe is way, way ahead of the rest of the world. All that progress took place during what was called the Dark Ages. How could that be? But, I mean, the fact is everything from gunpowder to stirrups to prop rotation to all kinds, you know, just this endless amount of progress had gone on.
Your sixth chapter deals with something called the myth of Protestantist individualism and suicide. And that gets us to the world of Durkheim. But also, this issue of individualism is actually one that still hangs with us very much today. And I have to read one of my very favorite quotes in your book. You're talking about Robert Bella, and Bella was very concerned about the individualism that America was facing in the 1950s, 60s, and 70s. Was very concerned about this, and you made the observation of Bella's Habits of the Heart having five authors, and that made me laugh out loud. In fact, you write there, Bella writes, "We are concerned that individuals have grown cancerous, that it may be destroying those social integuments that Tocqueville saw as moderating its more destructive potentialities, that it may be threatening the survival of freedom itself," to which you then respond, presumably, that is why the book had five authors, which just actually made me laugh out loud. What about Protestant individualism? To what extent is that real or is that a myth?
Well, there are a lot of things tied up here, but the basic thing is people like Bella and whatnot were basing the notion that Protestantism had produced individualism on a whole bunch of writings about family structure and whatnot that had changed and therefore produced individualism versus being familiarism and group, you know, villageism and all that sort of thing. Only trouble is that in the 60s and 70s came a whole mass of historical reconsiderations showing that it wasn't so, that these conditions had existed centuries again before the Reformation. Wherever this kind of individualism in Europe arose, it arose a lot sooner than Luther came along and nailed his thesis on the wall. By the way, there's some notion implied by the fact that he nailed his thesis on the door of the church, that this is an angry man out there really pounding it to the Catholic Church right then and there, and, you know, a real challenge. Not so. The church door of that particular church is where the faculty at that university used as a bulletin board. But it doesn't give you any romance when you say Luther nailed his and put his pinned his 95 theses on the bulletin board.
Yeah, yeah.
But if he nailed it to the church door, then it's really a big thing.
Yeah, we have all the paintings of that, and we've actually talked to some of our previous guests in this Protestant Reformation series who note that he might not have even done that. He just might have passed them around, and people said, well, he pinned them to the door, and then pinning them to the door becomes nailing them to the door, and it's the only thing that was nailed to the door, et cetera, et cetera. So the myth tends to grow from that, I guess. The other myth that you take up, and this is one that you've dealt with quite extensively throughout your career, is that Protestantism led to secularization. And this notion has been championed by the likes of Charles Taylor and Steve Bruth. In part, this myth takes us back to the discussion earlier that religion wasn't as widespread during the golden age of Christianity that everybody said, but there's a little bit more to it. Did Protestantism really lead to secularization, or what's going on here?
And the answer is no. It's twofold. First of all, secularization hasn't really happened. The world is more religious now than probably it's ever been. I have data and surveys from 166 nations, and that's every nation of any size, more than 300,000 people on Earth. And more than half of them were in church last week. It's just not there. Europe is lower than the rest of the world, and I think that historically one can demonstrate that it always was. And one of the reasons were all was this constant attempt at monopoly, not just limiting the continent to Christianity, because then you just say, well, then the same thing, you know, Muslim and Hindu and what. No, but the one brand, one organization of Christianity, that was always the attempt. It was the attempt to, I mean, remember, the Lutherans didn't bring any liberty along. I mean, the second the Lutherans took over, it was illegal to be anything but a Lutheran. It was a serious offense to be caught saying a mass in Northern Europe. As a matter of fact, the Scandinavian nations made a law that if you weren't a member of the state Lutheran Church, you weren't a citizen and you had to leave. So, but in the long run, the proliferation of Protestantism, in other parts of the world especially, has meant for competition. And just like in business and anything else, what you have to have a lot of people involved in the church is to have a lot of different churches out there competing to get them. And that's true in the United States. It's true all over Latin America now because of the arrival of Protestants. Catholics are going to church in Latin America like they never went before, in response, because the church has responded actively to the Protestant threat. Church going in sub-Saharan Africa is prodigious. Rates of, 80 to 90% of the people going every week. You look around the world and you find a great deal of religion, and in within Christianity, Protestantism has had that effect. I mean, it's been really good for the Catholic Church to get Protestant competition.
Yeah, that was one of the final chapters in your book, that Protestantism has actually proven to be a very good thing for Catholicism. It's not just a breakaway, but it has kept Catholicism on its toes, and Catholicism has kept Protestantism on its toes, as well as all the multiplicity of Protestant denominations where they do exist.
Yeah, well, I mean, there are whole books about the Counter-Reformation, mm-hmm. which did occur, and it was a wonderful thing for the church.
Yeah. We will be having a show soon on the Counter-Reformation, so folks, stick around for that. I want to take us away from the myth of the Reformation and just ask you another question, because you write books so fast, it's hard to keep up with you getting on the podcast here. But another book just came by way of my desk.
That's all I've got to do.
Well, we're glad that you're doing that. But one of the most recent books that you wrote, I had the chance to read, and I really enjoyed it, is a book called Why God? Explaining Religious Phenomena, wherein you make the claim that scholars have really taken God out of the study of religion. And I see this book as kind of a culmination of a lot of your other books and thinking as you've gone throughout the past few decades, and really coming to some major conclusions about how, not only about religion, but about how we study religion. So if you could, tell us, what do you mean about scholars taking God out of religion? What do you mean by that? How did you come to that realization? And what should scholars do from here on?
You know, as a kid in graduate school, I discovered that the overwhelming definition of religion explicitly excluded God. Durkheim said the notion of God is a very late invention in human history, and it has nothing to do with religion. Religion has to do with the society worshiping itself and social integration, and the gods are not important. And I looked at it and said, if you don't put belief in God in your definition of religion, you can't tell the village atheist from the village priest. And that doesn't make a lot of analytical sense. You can't tell the Nazi Party from the Roman Catholic Church. Does that make any sense? And it struck me that it didn't, for a number of reasons, but one of them is only those bodies of thought and practice that include a notion of life after death, and that always includes a notion of God, only they can offer otherworldly rewards. Now, the Communist Party can't do that. And it's always been an advantage the church has had in competition, when it was a fair competition. And that's why religion is so persistent. After all, the marvelous thing about, and we brought up the Communist Party, is that Russia had about 70 years of required training. Every year that you were in school, you had to take a class in scientific atheism. And when it all fell apart in the end of the 80s, in 1989, somebody did the first reliable survey in Russia, asked the question about belief in God, and found that it was 6% who said they were atheists. That, after 70 years of instruction, that wasn't doing very well. And the answer is, religion has got some resources that no other system of thought has. Now, you can say those beliefs are false. I'm not going to argue with you about that, but I'm saying is those beliefs are really important, and that they do have an enormous effect on life.
Now, that book is, I think, should be required reading for all those in religious studies and who are tackling the issues of the social scientific study of religion, if not social science writ broadly, because we oftentimes think that, you know, ideologies like communism or secular states have a great deal of staying power. And as I always point out to my colleagues, the Catholic Church has outlasted every single secular regime that you can think of throughout human history. And it's got to be something that we can learn from that. I want to finish off on a final question for you, given that you just wrote this book that says we need to put God back into religious studies. Are there any other words of advice that you want to give to younger scholars who are taking out into this field and thinking about studying religion from a social science perspective?
Yeah, always be suspicious of the received wisdom. If you have a sense that this doesn't seem to make sense to me, maybe it doesn't make sense. So go and work it out. I couldn't imagine that people sat there believing the Protestant ethic all these years. It made no sense. Durkheim's notion that the gods are not part of religion didn't make any sense. My non-academic friends would have immediately spotted these problems. And there's a way in which education can make you susceptible to real idiocy. I mean, you have to, as I've often said, you'd have to be a trained social scientist to believe that nonsense. And try to guard against that.
Definitely good words of advice to take forward with us. My guest today has been Rodney Stark. Rod, thanks for being on Research on Religion.
I enjoyed it a lot.
Thank you for listening to Research on Religion. To learn more about today's topic, participate in a discussion about what you've heard, or browse other podcasts, please visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org. And if you like what we're doing, please tell a friend. We'd appreciate the company. See you next week.